Happy Friday. Thank you for tuning in to the Matrix is Real podcast. My name is Anthony and I'm your host. Got a little treat for you today. I have the earliest known source text regarding Jesus. And amazingly, it's actually not anything related to the actual Bible, the Gospels, the New Testament. It actually was discovered by a Russian journalist by the name of Nicholas Notovich around 1887. That was actually the year he published it. I think he found it a couple years prior. But he published it in a book called The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. Nicholas Notovich claimed that while he was traveling in Ladakh, which is Little Tibet, he found a copy of an ancient Buddhist manuscript which talked about Jesus and said where he was during the lost years of the Gospels, particularly in India, various parts of Asia, and Nepal, etc. Notovich visited a Buddhist monastery at Molbeck, where he was told by the chief lama there that in the archives at Lhasa, which is the capital of Tibet, and at that time, the home of the Dalai Lama, there were several thousand ancient scrolls discussing the life of the prophet Isa, which is the Eastern name for Jesus. The Buddhist manuscript was discovered specifically at the Himis Monastery, which is the largest monastery in Ladakh. These manuscripts were supposedly orally given to the monks at these monasteries approximately 3 years after the crucifixion. The people that witnessed it were traveling merchants who were basically making their way through Jerusalem and Judea, and it took them about 3 years to get back to Asia. And it was significant because these texts put Jesus in Asia during those lost 16, 17 years, which the Gospels, the Bible, the New Testament, they just kind of gloss over. Nobody really wants to ever talk about it. But these merchants, they were in the very place that Jesus was studying in Asia, so they knew who he was. And so when they were going through Jerusalem and they see, you know, this huge ordeal going on, they naturally just ask, you know, what's going on? And, you know, everyone, the locals said, you know, they're crucifying this great man. His actual name was Yeshua, but Yeshua is translated in various parts in the East to Isa. So they recognized him. They knew who he was. They took these stories all the way back with them. So 3 years is the earliest known source text that I'm aware of that actually talks about Jesus with pretty, I mean, it seems like very highly accurate information. After that, the next earliest text, which has never been officially, like an actual copy has never been uncovered, but most mainstream theologians, almost all theologians that have actually studied it, accept it as an actual existing, book, but it's called Gospel Q. And Gospel Q explains how the four canonized Gospels in the New Testament have fundamental differences, but I believe it's Mark and Matthew have about 80 plus verses that are practically identical, even though they were written, I think it was 30 to 40 years apart, and the authors obviously didn't know each other. That only means one thing, is that there had to have been an earlier source text that the authors of both books were referencing. So that's the background, and I'll just jump into it. I think the reason, and this wasn't just Notovich. He came back, and when he published it, it was groundbreaking. It was, you know, people called it heresy and said he was lying and this and that. But there were actually several other people that went on the exact same journey that he went. And one lady named Madame Caspari, she took a photograph of the chief librarian at the monastery, who in the picture is holding up the texts, and his actual quote was, these texts say that your Jesus was here. I believe it was Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, I think his name is. He also made the journey out there and verified the same information. Another guy, I can't remember his name. Basically, there was a main at Oxford. There was a main professor that highly disagreed and with contempt, went after Notovich. His best, one of his best friends, a guy by the name of Swami, I'm going to butcher this, Amena. His name was Swami Abhedananda. And he was a close friend, like I said, of the main detractor for Notovich. He went the exact same journey and independently verified everything that Notovich claimed. He even found more texts that I don't believe were the exact same ones, but they said the same thing. So there were multiple source texts that basically said the exact same thing. So without further ado, I'm going to basically, it's not a very long book. There's about 80 pages. And the first four chapters deal with a little bit of the history of the Jews. It talks about Moses. In this book, it calls him Mossa. It talks about their flight from Egypt and a little bit of Jesus's his life as a young child. But I only focus on what did Jesus actually say, which I always find funny because most mainstream Christians seem to put a lot more stock into the Bible than versus the actual words that Jesus spoke. I mean, it's called Christianity, right? It's supposedly the faith as spoken by Jesus Christ. And Christ, by the way, was not his surname. Christ is a derivative of the word, the Greek word, Christo, which means the anointed one. They didn't have blast names back then. He was known as Jesus of Nazareth, or he was also called the Nazarene. But I'm of the opinion that God created the universal laws that govern our universe. There's a philosophy known as Taoism that describes the universe and God, the creator, as basically like a clockworker. God designed the clock, and he designed it with laws that govern the way that the clock actually functions. And God, you know, obviously is looking at the clock. He's apart from it, but he can reach in and manipulate it when he chooses. So with that in mind, I believe that logic or reason is one of the universal laws that governs our universe. Whenever somebody says, you know, it doesn't make sense, or, you know, not everything will make sense, I guarantee you every single thing that happens in the universe follows a universal law. The problem is, we as humans, our knowledge is so tiny compared to God. So we don't understand half of what's going on. We don't even understand a fraction of what's going on. You know, 1% probably of the entire universe, we probably still haven't even got there. So whenever something doesn't make sense, it's just we don't understand it enough. So with the Bible, and this is true for the Torah, the Talmud for the Jews, it's also I've read all the books, including the Quran, front to back. I am of the opinion that if God is trying to convert and teach the people to follow him and to serve him, you want to make it as concise and simple as possible. I mean, going back, you know, just a couple hundred years, the majority of people were illiterate. So it makes to me very little sense why the true one and only creator of the universe, God, the Most High, would make 500 page books that people would either have to read or listen to kind of get the full knowledge. So I focused on this book. I'm focusing specifically on what Jesus said. It's a very short book as it is. I trimmed it down even more so just to focus on what is Jesus's message and how should we live our lives. So again, without further ado, I'm going to start in chapter 5. So chapter 5, verse 4. They taught him to read and understand the Vedas, to cure by the aid of prayer, to teach, to explain the Holy Scriptures to the people, and to drive out evil spirits from the bodies of men, restoring them their sanity. So the Indian Vedas are the holy books for the faith of many people in India. Going on to verse 11 of chapter 5, he inveighed against the act of a man arrogating himself to the power to deprive his fellow beings of their rights of humanity. For, said he, God the Father makes no difference between his children. All to him are equally dear. Right now, with what's going on in the Middle East, the state of Israel is run by Zionists. And Zionism is inherently racist and is rooted in inequality. God's chosen people is what most Israelis, you know, that embrace Zionism will tell you is that's why they're better than you. But this is a verse right here that literally talks about equality. It says God loves all of his children. He doesn't make a distinction between them. All God's creation is equally dear to him. Verse 13, fear thy God, bend the knee before him only, and bring to him alone the offerings which proceed from thy gains. Today, Christians, Muslims, Jews, so many different people in this world, despite claiming that they actually worship God, they don't only worship God. They don't only bend the knee and do God's bidding. Statism has become a religion. Most people, I would say, you know, upwards of almost like, I'd say 80, 90% of people on this planet, without really knowing or realizing it, they subscribe to and follow the religion of statism. They worship the state. They worship the government. And case in point, in the United States of America, you don't have to lawfully pay income taxes if you know how the system works. And I understand most people don't know the ins and outs and all that, but Jesus said, resist not evil with evil. And don't pay taxes, in other words, don't pay tribute to Caesar, as it were, or to the government, or to a false god, if you don't have to. If you can find a way to not do it voluntarily, you don't do it. How many people pay taxes or vote or do things in their daily lives out of fear of what the government will do to them? It says, fear thy God and alone. If you're living in fear of the government, you're obviously not doing it right. Verses 15 to 18. The Judge Eternal, the Eternal Spirit, comprehends the one and indivisible soul of the universe, which alone creates, contains, and vilifies all. He alone has willed and created. He alone has existed since all eternity, and his existence will have no end. He has no equal either in the heavens or on earth. The great creator has not shared his power with any living being, still less with inanimate objects, as they have taught to you. For he alone possesses omnipotence. He willed it, and the world appeared. In a divine thought, he gathered together the waters, separating from them the dry portion of the glove. He is the principle of the mysterious existence of man, in whom he has breathed a part of his being. So this is what Islam is about. Islam is about monotheism. I believe the reason why, because I believe they're all interconnected. People don't realize that the Quran is essentially a continuation of the Gospels. And it starts with the Jewish Torah and the Talmud, the Old Testament, basically the Bible, goes to the New Testament, and then goes to the Quran. The whole reason, and this is what basically Muslims believe, the whole reason why the Prophet Muhammad was called by God was essentially Christians and the rest of the world were pivoting toward a pagan worship. And how is that possible? You know, Christianity, Jesus was God. What does it say there? It says God has not shared his power with any living being. In other words, God is God alone. There is no such thing as the Trinity. Jesus was not the literal Son of God. So any Christian out there, which around the time of Muhammad, there was a lot of them. Every Christian out there is actually worshiping a false idol, a false god. Jesus was not the literal Son of God. Jesus himself said, I am the finger of God. God is basically working through me, and all things are possible through God, as we've all been taught to believe, but that's literal, including Jesus. So no gods but gods, no blood sacrifices. Verses 20 to 22. The anger of God will soon be let loose against man, for he has forgotten his creator. He has filled his temples with abominations, and he worships a crowd of creatures which God has made subordinate to him. For to do honor to stones and metals, he sacrifices human beings in whom dwells a part of the spirit of the Most High. For he humiliates those who work by the sweat of their brow to acquire the favor of an idler seated at his sumptuous board. For man, this is a continuation, this is chapter 6, 8 to 10. For man, he said, he has not been permitted to see the image of God, and yet he has made a host of deities in the likeness of the eternal. So essentially, we don't know what God looks like, but we're creating depictions of what God is to us, which by definition is a false idol. Moreover, it is incompatible with the human conscience to make less matter of the grandeur of divine purity than of animals and objects executed by the hands of man in stone or metal. The eternal lawgiver is one. There is no other God but he. He has not shared the world with anyone, neither has he informed anyone of his intentions. This is again, if Jesus was the literal Son of God, why didn't he know it was going to happen? Whenever stuff was about to happen to Jesus, what did he do? He turned to God in prayer and said, God, basically guide me. This is because, again, Jesus was not the literal Son of God. He was a prophet like Muhammad and was sent here, and God worked through him because Jesus practiced what we all should be practicing. And I think that's the greatest conspiracy, and the purpose of it is the conspiracy of who Jesus was. If the world knew the truth that Jesus was almost certainly a regular mortal just like the rest of us, that means that his greatness is possible within us all. We all carry Christ within our hearts. What kind of world would it be for the elites that are pushing us to war and pushing war in the Middle East and mass murder of children by Israel bombing Gaza and putting poison in the food and, you know, everything, the criminal justice system locking up people for nonviolent victimless crimes. I mean, I may not agree with drug use, but if somebody's getting high in their basement and they don't hurt anyone, that's their business. The world would be vastly different than what we live in today if everyone, I'm not saying everyone reached the same level of Jesus, but what if we were reaching toward that and we were exceeding what we're capable of now? Continuing on, chapter 5:23, it says, God will punish those who take away the freedoms of others. That was my part, my description. This is the actual quote. Those who deprive the brethren of divine happiness shall be deprived of it themselves. Because in the day of the last judgment, the ignorant will be forgiven much because of their ignorance, while God, on the contrary, will punish with his wrath those who have arrogated to themselves his rights. In Sunday school, I was always taught, you know, of hell, fear hell, fire and brimstone. Even more so, fear God. I always took that word to mean not fear. I mean, fear to me, what did Yoda say in Star Wars? Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear is a root of the evil, essentially. So we shouldn't fear God. We should be respectful of God's power, like a father, you know, in his house with his kids. Kids shouldn't live in fear of their father, right? They shouldn't live in fear that dad's gonna beat the crap out of them, or dad's gonna scream and hurt their ears, or scare them, you know. They should just live with the respect that I know what my dad's capable of. And he can destroy things if he really wanted to, but he loves not only me, but he embraces morality and righteousness and goodness. So that's the distinction right there. But God is saying also, more specifically, God will forgive. And this was a question I always had, is if you're living in South America or you're a Native American, you know, 500 years ago, and nobody's ever come to you talking about Jesus, how is it you're damned to hell if you haven't accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? Well, the answer is right there. Ignorance. God understands that not everyone has been shown the truth for whatever reason. They came from a poor village. They didn't travel much. They live in an undeveloped, you know, part of the third world. The point is that God has mercy, and God will forgive those that have been led astray because of their own ignorance. However, those who have knowledge of the truth and who deliberately steer God's children away from him and take away their rights while they're on earth, they will not be spared. Those are the ones that will have to deal with God's judgment. So, again, simplicity. This is Jesus' simple instructions to how to live a godly life in basically four verses. Chapter 5, 26. Worship not the idols, for they hear you not. Listen not to the Vedas or any religious book, for their truth is counterfeit. Never put yourself in the first place, and never humiliate your neighbor. Help the poor, support the weak, do ill to no one, and covet not which thou hast not, and which thou seest belongeth to another. So again, only one God but God. and be good to others as you would to yourself. The golden rule that Jesus talked about. Chapter 7, verses 15 through 18. Do not steal the goods of your neighbor, for that would be to deprive him of what he has acquired by the sweat of his brow. Deceive no one, so as not to be yourselves deceived. Endeavor to justify yourself before the last judgment, for then it will be too late. Do not give yourselves up to debauchery, for that would be to violate the laws of God. Be a good person. Don't steal. Don't lie. Show morality in your relations. Debauchery. OnlyFans today, or you know, people doing porn, or you know, people having open marriages. That's debauchery. That's not the way that God, you know, look in nature overall. Yeah, you might have an alpha male like a lion, but you don't see all these, you know, lionesses intermingling with other lions. There's an established order of things. With humans and a lot of other species of animals, you have monogamous relationships. That's the ultimate goal. And yeah, various parts of society, in Islam, for example, people constantly criticize the Prophet Muhammad because he had so many wives and one of them was a child. Number one, context, that was the practice at the time, is that if a woman was widowed and she didn't have a man to support her, she was basically up for marriage again, so she was taken care of. As far as a child, from all my research, is that Muhammad did not consummate the marriage. It's one thing to marry a child, which, you know, in today's society, that would be obviously frowned upon. But it's very different to marry somebody and say, one day, you know, you're my wife, and one day we will be fully husband and wife. But it's another thing to consummate. Muhammad did not sleep with that child. He waited till she was of age, and that's when they consummated the marriage. And this practice was done by the Jews as well. So you want to single out Islam? Well, the Jews did it too. So did the Christians. It was common practice at that time. Jesus also, I didn't write the quote here, but Jesus actually studied for 6 years at again, probably going to butcher this, Guadamites, which was the birthplace of Buddha. So Buddha lived 500 years prior to Jesus. Jesus traveled to the East to basically learn more about Eastern spirituality, specifically things like Buddhism. And he actually studied in the very same place that Buddha did, which is why, if you look at the New Testament and why Jesus's ministry was so different than everyone else's, is that, in my view, he embraced the spirituality of Buddhism. The oneness of all is that you can't harm your neighbor because you invariably harm yourself. You have to take care of the earth, because if you poison the earth, you're poisoning yourself. That's what Buddhism teaches. We're all one, and we're all connected by the divine creation, whether that's God or whatever you want to perceive that as. Whatever created us unites us all, whether we can see those connections or not. We all... Now, a point that I always had a hard time wrapping around my head in Sunday school at church was, I mean, when we talk about Satanism is usually really, really closely related to things like blood sacrifice, to cannibalism, you know, drinking blood, to human sacrifices, killing, you know, children and other people, even animals, and offering that blood to Satan, did the devil. Prior to Jesus being in Jerusalem, the high priests did the same thing. As animal sacrifice was a major factor and role. In Jerusalem, it was a major factor and a major role in Jerusalem, Judea, anywhere where the Jews were. That was common practice. And it's not surprising that one of the first things, everyone always focuses about Jesus overturning the tables and whipping the money changers with a whip made out of reeds. Which, by the way, side note, when everyone says, what would Jesus do? Remember that. Flipping tables and beating the crap out of people with a whip, that's within the realm of possibilities for Jesus, right? He wasn't a pacifist like everyone says out. Resist not evil with evil, but it's that old motto, do no harm, but take no shit. Pardon my language. There's a lot of people and some evidence that says that it was actually the Jewish high priests themselves that basically distorted the laws of Moses and commanded that the animal sacrifices for several reasons. One, it was lucrative. It paid well, because to get these animals that were blessed by the Jewish high priest, you had to pay money for it. But then also, when they would sacrifice the animals, guess where they gave the meat? The Jewish high priests. So it was eating meat, you know, in various parts of the world, even today, is a luxury, right? So back then, same thing. The peasants didn't eat a lot of animals. You go to ancient Egypt, majority of the population was pretty much vegetarian, if not fully vegetarian. And which leads to the next part. Organized religion and its leaders have been corrupted and leads people away from God. Chapter 6, 15 through 16. Wherefore I say unto you, leave your idols and perform not rites which separate you from your father, associating you with the priests from whom the heavens have turned away. For it is they who have led you from the true God, and whose superstitions and cruelties conduce to the perversion of your soul and the loss of all moral sense. Just what I said earlier. It was likely the Jewish high priest that started talking and promoting animal sacrifice. In chapter 7, verse 5, Jesus answers his critics who say to prove the existence of God. The miracles of our God have been worked since the first day when the universe was created. They take place every day and at every moment. Whosoever seeth them not is deprived of one of the fairest gifts of life. In other words, I don't need to perform a miracle to you, like something as simple as childbirth. It's pretty much impossible when you really break it down, the actual function of childbirth, or how, you know, when we get injured, our body naturally knows how to fix itself. That is evidence of God's creation of miracles. And if you can't see that, I don't know what to tell you. You're missing out, is what basically Jesus says. In chapter 7, verses 11, God says he will punish those who lead people away from him, but have mercy on those he led astray. This is, again, reinforcing what was said earlier. God will drive the impure from among his flocks, but he will take back to himself those who have gone astray, though not having recognized the portion of spirituality within them. The truest way to experience God is to feel his presence, which is what Jesus says in chapter 7 and verse 13. And Anissa further taught the pagans how not to strive to see the eternal spirit with their eyes, but to endeavor to feel them in their hearts and by the purity of their soul to render themselves worthy of his favors. Here's a big one, what I was talking about earlier. Sacrifice not animals. In chapter 7, verse 14. Not only, said he unto them, abstain from consuming human sacrifices, but immolate no creature to whom life has been given, for all things that exist have been created for the profit of man. This goes back to how I've spoken to a lot of Christians on this one, when it says in the book of Genesis, which, by the way, Genesis, I believe, is 1:22, God says that the Garden of Eden was vegan. And we lived in a world where, you know, lions existed and all these like meat-eating predators, they existed. But at that time, they didn't have to kill another animal to survive. All of Eden was vegan. And it specifically says that God says that all the seed-bearing plants I give to you for food. Later in Genesis, it says, I give dominion over all of my creation, over all the animals to you. Dominion. People think that that just means you can just do whatever you want. Oh, it's mine. I can just, you know, do whatever I want. Our role in this world is not only to protect ourselves, but to protect where we live, because that has a very intrinsic and big connection to our well-being. So when God gave dominion to the animals, when God gave dominion to us over his animal creation, it was to protect. You know, we're not supposed to go and destroy the rainforest, and we're not supposed to engage in mass factory farming that kills over 40 billion animals a year. Did you know that? Over 40 billion, with a B, billion animals are killed every year in factory slaughterhouses to feed man's taste buds. I've been vegan for over 10 years. I'm healthier than I've ever been. I'm stronger than I've ever been. I'm faster. I have more endurance. I everything across the board, I'm better at now, even though I'm older. And yet, we live in a world that tells us you need to eat animals, which, again, the biggest animals on planet Earth, the most strongest animals on planet Earth, the gorilla, the elephant, the whales, they all are plant eaters. So all protein, this is also a scientific fact, all protein comes from plants, because it starts off as grass and the cows eat it. And then, you know, go back to the very beginning of any animal that's eaten as food. What were they eating? All protein comes from plants. So my argument always has been, why not skip the animals or just the middleman? Why engage in a cruel diet where you literally are killing an animal, which it said earlier, the spirit of God dwells within all of his creation, which includes animals. So when you kill an animal, you're literally killing a part of God, if you want to think about it. And why? Oh, well, meat tastes good. So really, you're literally killing something because it tastes good. Why don't you kill, like, I wonder how kids taste. I wonder how, you know, people taste. There's a reason we don't kill them. Why? Oh, well, it's the same race as us. We're the same species. No. It's because it's wrong. You don't kill things just to satisfy your superficial cravings, essentially. Not only... Oh, I read that. I'm sorry. I was about to reread the same thing. People say you don't go to church. You know, you don't go to church. Why don't you go to church? Church is just a building. In chapter 9, verses 11 through 14, and Esau made the answer to them that God had not in view temples erected by the hands of man, but meant that the human heart was the true temple of God. Did you hear that? The true temple of God is your heart. That's why your heart has, this is scientific fact, your heart basically has its own mind, its own brain. We have certain types of neural cells in our heart that are similar to the ones that are firing in our brain. And I can't remember the exact amount, I think it's 40,000, but basically the electromagnetic field that's put off by our heart, we can't see it, but if we could, it's actually stronger and bigger than the one put off by our mind. So whenever, you know, we always hear follow your heart, that's God. Follow your heart, because your heart knows more than your mind. Your mind is the liar. Your heart knows what's true, because that is where the Spirit of God dwells. Enter into your temple, into your heart, illuminate it with good thoughts and the patience and immovable confidence which you should have in your Father. And your sacred vessels, they are your hands and your eyes. See and do that which is agreeable to God, for in doing good to your neighbor, you accomplish an act which embellishes the temple wherein dwells he who gave you life. For God has created you in his own likeness, innocent with pure souls and hearts filled with goodness, destined not for the conception of evil schemes, but made to be sanctuaries of love and justice. It was James, the brother of Jesus, that said, faith without works is dead. And it was that again, modern Christianity, people don't realize this. Modern Christianity is rooted in Pauline theology. Apostle Paul, aka Saul of Tarsus, claimed that he saw Jesus in the spirit form outside the gates of Damascus, who then gave him this holy new religion to spread to primarily the Gentiles, not even the Jews, because the Jews rejected his teachings. It was James who was actually the head of the apostolic council. Basically, James was leading the Jesus community after his brother's crucifixion. He was the head honcho. After hearing the lies that Saul was putting out about his brother, he recalled him. You can read this in the book of Acts. He recalls him to Jerusalem to undergo a purification ritual in the very temple that Paul was saying was no longer necessary, because you didn't need to go to the temple. You didn't need to perform good works. You just needed to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. And then, you know, easy street. You can sit, hear people all the time say, you know, well, I'll just live a sinful life, and then, you know, when I'm about to die, I can always, you know, repent and ask for God's forgiveness and accept him as my Lord and Savior. It's like, that's not how it works. That's faith without works, and that faith is dead. You're living a sinful, evil life. You need to have faith, obviously, in God, but your faith has to be shown by how you act. It was Morpheus in the movie The Matrix. It's one thing to know the path. It's another to walk it. Chapter 9, 16, this describes how acts of love or piety should be selfless. You should basically do good works just because you want to, not because you're going to get benefit or because you want to be thought of as a good person or because you're going to, you know, get something in return. If you wish to accomplish works marked with love or piety, do them with an open heart and let not your actions be governed by calculations of hope or of gain. Going back to the main, you know, point of Buddhism is that the oneness of us all, the golden rule. The golden rule of Jesus is essentially Buddhism 101. Treat others how you want to be treated. Helping others helps yourself. Chapter 10, verse 9. He who sustains his neighbor sustains himself. And whosoever protects his family protects the people and the state. We're in a world today where, you know, the traditional nuclear family, a mom, dad, and kids, that's being pulling apart. And there's a reason for that. What does it just say there? If you protect your family, you protect your neighbors, and you protect your country. You essentially protect God's creation. We live in a world where right now, family time and family importance is in Western culture is one of the like furthest thing away from the top of the priority list. Social media is more important these days than raising a good, tight-knit family. How many families these days sit down at the dinner table, say, pray, and give thanks for their food, and spend time talking to each other, looking at each other? No, most people sit on the couch, or they're in their car, or they go to the, you know, fast food, and they're on their phones while they're eating. And nobody says thanks, and, you know, it's just, it's completely backwards. Same thing. This was on the Sermon on the Mount. Resist not evil with evil. That, in my opinion, is the biggest point of Jesus's ministry, is by responding to evil with evil, you're basically dropping yourself down to the very level of the people that you're calling out as being evil. Chapter 10, verse 13. Earthly power is not of long duration, and it is subject to many changes. Of what use that man should revolt against it, seeing that one power always succeeds to another power? And thus it will come to pass until the extinction of humanity. This is something, a lesson that has been hard learned for me. For a long time, I embraced what's called zeal. A lot of the Jews prior to Jesus was not the first supposed Messiah. There was a lot of people that claimed that title for themselves. Right before Jesus was born, right around the time he was born, Judas the Galilean basically led a fierce revolt against Rome, engaging in a guerrilla warfare. They robbed the armories in Judea, and they used the weapons that they stole from the Romans to basically launch a bloody campaign against the occupying forces, which, by the way, sounds very similar to what's going on in Gaza today. But I used to believe that we need to worship and serve God and God alone, and resort to arm resistance, essentially, if necessary. What October 7th has taught me, and I, a lot of people, this is the danger with words. Words are powerful. There's not a Jew problem in the world. There's no Jew hate in the world right now. But a lot of people are grouping two different groups together and calling them the same thing: Zionists and Jews. They're not the same thing. Zionists, or Zionism, is a political ideology that hides behind the faith of Judaism. In reality, Zionism is racist. It's based in inequality. It's based on evil and hatred, and it's based on violence. So when people like Kanye West say that the Jews control Hollywood, they control banking and finance, that's the danger. We need to start using the correct language. It's not the Jews that control everything. Maybe they identify as Jews and they have the Star of David, you know, flag behind all their pictures and stuff, but that's not a true Jew. A true Jew is somebody that observes the laws of Moses, that obeys the Torah, and that if you read the Torah, it basically says, treat, just everything I'm reading right now, treat your fellow man the way you want to be treated. And one of the biggest things that the Orthodox Jewish movement, not all of them, some Orthodox Jews are Zionists, but some of them, like the Hasidic Jews that you see wearing, you know, the classic a black hat and black garb and stuff like that, they're the ones that are protesting with the pro-Palestinians on the streets right now, saying, you know, Jews against Zionism. The state of Israel has no right to exist. The Zionist state of Israel should be dismantled. These are the Jews that I've developed so much respect for. Their message has opened my eyes to this point right here, is that God is in control. And what we need to show God is our obedience, even when things get rough. Go back to the Israelites in Egypt. They were slaves for a long, long, long time. They could have drawn up arms, and actually some of them tried to. And they could have tried to free themselves, but that was not going according to God's laws. So there are some Jews that are anti-Zionists that actually say that the Holocaust was God's wrath for the majority of Jews straying away from the laws of Moses and the Torah. And that, in other words, when things go rough, we need to stop looking at the bad guys and pointing the finger at them and saying they're bad, we need to oppose them and stuff like that. the Torah and then these Jews I'm describing, they literally said, it says it, and they believe that God is the one that sends the bad guys. People, a lot of times, this is a major point in Islam that I've come to learn, is that we're supposed to basically be grateful to God for our struggle, because God gave us our struggle so that we can basically pivot and turn back toward Him. We're going the wrong way. And sometimes, just like a father or a mother has to give their kids tough love, sometimes you have to give tough love to right the situation. The example that I read before, a father, his son is injured, and they rush him to the hospital, and the doctor says, "Sir, I can save your son, but I have to perform this surgery, and I can't give your son medication. I can't put him under. He's gonna have to be awake and feel everything." So the father agrees, you know, and says, "Okay," and the son is in the operating room, and he's basically being operated on and feeling the most intense pain imaginable, screaming out. He looks around as this is happening, and he doesn't see his dad, and he thinks that his father abandoned him. That's what happens in this world. Whenever things are going bad for us, just because we can't see God doesn't mean that God has turned away from us. God is simply just hiding his face right now. And that's where we need to show faith, and that is our weapon. Our weapon is faith, because God will right the ship when the time comes. Jesus, supposedly speaking to Paul, like I said, created a whole new religion. This verse, chapter 10, verses 19 to 21, shows that's not what Jesus was really doing. And so Paul actually was called a liar and had to defend himself as a liar. But getting into it, and the learned elders put him this question: "It is said that thou deniest the laws of Mosa, and that thou teachest the people to forsake the temple of God." And Isa replied, "One cannot demolish that which has been given by our Heavenly Father, neither that which has been destroyed by sinners. But I have enjoined the purification of the heart from all blemish, for it is the true temple of God. As to the laws of Mosa, I have endeavored to establish them in the hearts of men. And I say unto you that you do not understand their real meaning, for it is not vengeance but mercy that they teach. Only the sense of these laws has been perverted." Jesus didn't come back to start a new religion. He didn't come back to be, hey, everyone needs to be Christian now. He came back and he said, just like I'm saying, the ruling religious authorities that are telling you how to live your life and telling you how to worship God and live and serve Him, they're lying to you. They corrupted the scriptures that you're reading. They corrupted the books that you're reading. I'm here to set the record straight. And that's what I feel. I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal here, but there's others like me. There's this knowledge is penetrating throughout the world in minorities, but it's getting out there. I believe myself and people like me were literally sent by God to start spreading awareness about this, because that is the true second coming. It's not the second coming of the literal person, Jesus of Nazareth. It's the establishment and return of Christ's consciousness, of us all basically being linked up as directly to God and living our lives accordingly. This is a big one. Remember, this is all the Buddhist manuscripts. Today, Jews are hated, I feel, by a lot of Christians for not only crucifying Jesus, but denying that he was the Messiah. And they blame the Jews for sending Jesus to the cross, when, like I said at the very start of this, it was actually the Romans that did that. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 4. "Having hearkened unto Isa, the priests and wise elders decided amongst themselves not to judge him, for he did harm to no one. And presenting themselves before Pilate, appointed governor of Jerusalem by the pagan king of Romulus," which is Rome, "they addressed him as thus: We have seen the man whom thou accusest of inciting our people to rebellion. We have heard his discourses, and we know him to be our compatriot. But the chief of the cities have made thee false reports, for this is a just man who teaches the people of the word of God. After having interrogated him, we dismissed him, that he might go in peace." The governor, which was Pontius Pilate, then became enraged and sent near to Isa his servants in disguise, so that they might watch all his actions and report to the authorities the least word that he should address the people. If you read about Pontius Pilate, he's portrayed in the Gospels as, as a good man. I don't really want to crucify Jesus, but my hands are tied. Like, that's how they frame him. In reality, Pilate was a brutal, bloodthirsty person. He sent so many people to the cross in such a short period of time that the Jewish authorities actually sent an official complaint to Rome, to the emperor, saying, your governor is not... Because Jerusalem, Judea, was a Roman province. So it's under the protection of Rome. It has to pay taxes. And it just like the United States and any other country on earth, if you're protected by the government, you have the rights of that government. And the government is basically charged with enforcing those rights and protecting them. After the crucifixion of Jesus, Pilate, he only lasted a couple more years. And eventually, because of his brutality, he was actually exiled to a remote island. I think it was Gaul. This is a big one today, is be not deceived by miracles performed by man or false prophets. We're living in a world where it's not just, you know, oh, this person is claiming to be a new Messiah. That's not what it's talking about. It's don't be deceived by this, by the claimed miracles of anything or anyone. COVID-19. Remember Operation Warp Speed when Donald Trump, you know, prides himself that I'm the reason it came out so quickly. It wasn't Biden. It wasn't anyone. It was me. That was a miracle, right? We miraculously figured out how to solve this new global pandemic, and we have this magical shot that we came up with in 9 months when almost every other vaccine in history has taken over 10 years to develop. This is a miracle. It's a miracle. Here, take it. Don't be deceived. Do not believe in miracles wrought by the hand of man, for he who dominates over nature is alone capable of doing that which is supernatural, whilst man is powerless to stay the anger of the winds or to spread the rain. And all things which are done without God are but errors, seductions, and enchantments, which only demonstrate to the extent the soul of him who practices the art is shamelessness, falsehood, and impurity. Put not your faith in oracles. God alone knows the future. He who has recourse to diviners profanes the temple which is in his heart and gives a proof of distrust toward his creator. Faith in diviners and oracles destroys the innate simplicity of man and his childlike purity. An infernal power takes possession of him, forcing him to to commit all sorts of crimes and to worship idols. Oracles, that's a big one. When people said, you know, if we don't get this COVID shot, we're going to have this many deaths. Nobody knows that. They're predictions, and they were all shown to be completely false. Something just to consider, because they keep talking about at the X virus and the next big virus that's going to happen. I hope you learned your lesson from COVID not to trust the ruling authorities. Your faith, have faith in God, not the government. Again, related to what I just talked about, turn to God in always, even in sickness. Chapter 11, verse 12. Whereas the Lord our God, who has no equal, is one almighty, omniscient, and omnipresent. It is he who possesses all wisdom and light. It is to him you must address yourselves to be consoled in your sorrows, helped in your works, and cured in your sickness. Whosoever shall have recourse to him shall not be denied. I'm not one of those people, you know, that... You actually get a legitimate disease that they know about, and you know you need to take this medication, or you break your arm and you got to put a cast on it. I'm not one of those people that says, hey, you know, sit down and pray. You know, God has given us again the knowledge to help heal ourselves, and maybe one day we'll get to the point where we can literally heal broken bones, you know, just with our faith. But right now we're not there yet. We need to practice more. But ultimately, your faith should always go to God in your sickness. It shouldn't be going to big pharmaceuticals. It shouldn't be going to the government. Don't trust anything that doesn't agree with your good sense. That's what Buddha said. Don't trust anything that disagrees with your good sense and moral judgment. And this is a big one today. I mean, the whole COVID thing. I remember I reported on the lab leak theory. I think it was in January 2020, before COVID was even officially like named, I think, and before it was officially declared a pandemic. That came about a month and a half later. We're playing God today. I mean, look at what Elon Musk is doing with Neuralink. We're literally implanting chip implants in people's brains under the guise of, you know, hey, you can give paraplegics their arms back. You know, that's all good. But like, we don't know with things like this, is just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. I don't think a lot of these new technologies should be like, just think of a new iPhone. You get a new iPhone, the newest one with all the new latest gadgets, what happens? They need to do software updates. The hardware doesn't work properly. You have all these, the newest one that came out, it's overheating in people's pockets. I remember a couple years ago, the Samsung was literally lighting on fire. You gotta take time until you fully understand things in order to follow through with them. That's where playing God comes in. Unless you actually know what God knows on any specific subject, you shouldn't be messing with it, is how I feel. But the specific verse, chapter 11:14, the secret of nature is in the hands of God. For the world, before it appeared, existed in the depth of divine thought. It became material and visible by the will of the Most High. Which, that one's an interesting one, the whole idea of simulation theory. Everything existed in God's mind before it became physical. So maybe we are indeed living in a simulation like so many others, like Stephen Hawking. Even though I'm not a fan of him, Elon Musk. A lot of people that are pretty powerful and mainstream have said this. When you address yourselves to him, become again his children, for you know neither past, the present, nor the future, and God is the master of time. When we worship God and pray to God, we have to approach him like a child. We have to, that A shows humbleness, but B, it shows absolute faith. You have faith in your parents. Maybe you don't know how they're going to do it, but you don't doubt them. When dad, you know, hey, we need to pay this bill. You might worry as a kid, but ultimately you have faith that dad's going to figure it out or mom's going to figure it out together. This is one that I've had to battle, and my understanding has changed. But basically, Jesus was a political anarchist, but specifically, he was more of a spiritual anarchist. In chapter 12, verses 1 through 7, righteous man said unto him, the spies of the governor of Jerusalem, tell us if we shall perform the will of our Caesar or await our speedy deliverance. And Issa, having recognized them as people appointed to follow him, replied, I have not said to you that you shall be delivered from Caesar. It is the soul that is plunged in error that shall have its deliverance. As there can be no family without a head, so there can be no order among a people without a Caesar. To him, implicit obedience should be given, he alone being answerable for his acts before the supreme tribunal. The spies asked him, well, does Caesar possess a divine right? They further asked, and is he the best of mortals? Jesus replied, there should be no better among men, but there are also sufferers whom those elected and charged with this mission should care for, making use of the means conferred on them by the sacred law of our Heavenly Father. Mercy and justice are the highest attributes of a Caesar. His name will be illustrious if he adheres to them. But he who acts otherwise, who exceeds the limit of their power that has over his subordinates, going so far as to put their lives in danger, offends the great judge and loses his dignity in the sight of man. Jesus performed what I call spiritual jiu-jitsu. When he was confronted with questions that try to give a yes or no answer, and either answer is wrong, he would basically give he was speaking parables, and only the people that truly understood them would get the overall message. So you couldn't charge him with saying, you know, we shouldn't support Caesar. In this, he basically says that a Caesar not only should be the greatest of men because he has the most power and thus the most responsibility, but mercy and justice are the highest attributes of this person, and his name will be great if he follows that, if he basically serves God. But if he doesn't, he's gonna the one that's gonna have to answer to God, essentially. And in terms, again, of resisting on evil with evil, we live in a society where we do need some sort of order, and maybe one day we won't. Maybe one day enough people will turn to God that we'll live in a utopia. But the way history has worked for a long, long time is we need some sort of law and order. And without some sort of, you know, governing body, if you look in history, we've lived like animals, basically. So that's where he basically answers correctly, so he's not guilty of sedition at that point, is that we should give our obedience to Caesar. But basically, he's going to have to answer for his own mistakes. Now, this part right here, if you read the Bible, overall, it's a patriarchy. You know, a lot of feminists have a problem with Christianity because it's rooted in men having all the power and all the rights, it seems like, on the surface. And I think this part right here is one of the reasons why not many people know about this existence of these scriptures. Chapter 12, verses 8 through 13. This is about women. At this juncture, an old woman who had approached the group, the better to hear Issa, was pushed aside by one of the spies who placed himself before her. Then Issa held forth, it is not meet that a son should set aside his mother, taking her place. Whosoever respects not his mother, the most sacred being after his God, is unworthy of the name son. Listen then to what I say unto you. Respect woman, for she is the mother of the universe, and all the truth of divine creation lies in her. She is the basis of all that is good and beautiful, and she is also the germ of life and death. On her depends the whole existence of man, for she is his natural and moral support. She gives birth to you in the midst of suffering. By the sweat of her brow, she rears you, and until her death, you cause her the gravest of anxiety. Bless her and worship her, for she is your one friend, your support on this earth. Respect her, uphold her. In acting thus, you will win her love and her heart. You will find favor in the sight of God, and many sins shall be forgiven of you. This is an idea that is embraced by many different Eastern spiritual practices, including also in Africa. A lot of African tribes embrace this. Men might be the physical protectors of a society. You need men because we're stronger, we're bigger, we're faster. We are responsible for protecting the physicality, their physical presence of man. But women literally bring life into this world. Women have a portal within themselves from wherever we come from before and wherever we go after we die. That is the portal which life comes out of. So I've heard this before when it comes to, you know, sex trafficking of children by these elites, which are practicing Satanists. Why is it that these Satanists and pedophiles just have to always like attack kids and hurt kids? And I can't remember the interview, but there was an interview of a woman that was an insider. And she said, what I can tell you is that children are the closest you can get to God in this world, because they're not corrupted, and because they're separated so little from that other world that they came from. So you want to go from children. The youngest children are basically the absolute closest you can get to God. So, you know, babies and stuff like that. So we can accept that. But then that also means that women, which have that portal within them, they are also essentially divine as well. They are also as close as you can get to God. Therefore, they should be respected. Continuing, how we should respect women. Chapter 12, verse 13. In the same way, love your wives and respect them, for they will be mothers tomorrow, and each ladder on the ancestress of a race. Being lenient toward women, her love enables man, softens his hardened heart, tames the brute in him, and makes him of a lamb. Chapter 12, verse 16. The wife and the mother are inappreciable treasures given unto you by God. They are the fairest ornaments of existence, and of them shall be born all the inhabitants of the world. Next verse, verse 17. Even as the God of armies separated of old the light from the darkness and the land from the waters, women possess the divine faculty of separating in a man good intentions from evil thoughts. In other words, again, men are the physical leaders of this world. Women are the spiritual ones. That old saying, behind every great man is a great woman. That's this right here, is that I can speak from my own life experiences. When I was a young man, very hardened heart, didn't have much patience, didn't have a lot of empathy, didn't have the depth of love in my heart that I have today. Maybe it was there, but I wasn't accessing it yet. And it was the love or the experience that I had with women close in my life that have made me like a lamb in that way. And if you can be a masculine, you know, man that can protect and when push comes to shove, make sure that you protect your family and your friends. But you can also, a real man is also gentle with children. A real man, you know, doesn't get drunk and yell and scream at his kids and doesn't hit them and stuff like that. A real man has patience and can listen and can be also a source of support for not only women, but other men. After God, a man's loyalty and love should be reserved for women, because women contain the temple of God for man. Chapter 12, 18 and 19. Wherefore I say unto you, after God, your best thoughts should belong to women, and the wives, women being for you and the temple wherein you will obtain the most easily perfect happiness. Imbue yourselves in this temple with moral strength. Here you will forget your sorrows and your failures, and you will recover the lost energy necessary to enable you to help your neighbor. Personally, this verse right here makes me think of, you know, of sexual relations. I mean, women have a temple where you will obtain the imbue yourselves in this temple with moral strength. You know, making love to your wife, you're going to forget all your sorrows, And that's why I don't think a lot of women understand how powerful that act and why, how important it is for man. They don't get it. This is the example I've been given by other women. Women crave attention. For women, attention is like sex. That's why a lot of women in this day, because of social media and various other things, they always seem to want attention from other men. It validates them, makes them feel, you know, beautiful and all that. But when men are the opposite. Men need the physical stuff. Men need sex. So that is why men should give women attention. You should always pay good attention to your woman and satisfy her needs, you know. But it goes both ways. And part of what makes a man is finding that home within his wife, essentially, is that not only the physical sex act, but sex stands for sexual exchange of energy. Spiritual exchange. There was an acronym, but basically sex is an acronym basically for this exchange of spiritual energy. There's a reason why, you know, when you have sex with somebody that you love and you're married and stuff like that, you feel alive after the fact, you know, if it's really done correctly. Treat women with respect and don't humiliate them. Chapter 12, verse 20. Do not expose her to humiliation. In acting thus, you would humiliate yourself and lose the sentiment of love, without which nothing exists here below. Next verse. Protect your wife in order that she may protect you and all your family. All that you do for your wife, your mother, for a widow, or another woman in distress, you will have done unto your God. So that's the end of the part about women, and I'm almost done here. But basically, the takeaway from there is such a huge portion of this of these Buddhist manuscripts that talks about how we need to elevate and the word is used, worship women. I mean, I don't think in place of God, obviously, but that word is used just to show how important women are and how much they should be respected and loved and cared for. And it goes just like the golden rule. If you treat a woman right, she will treat you right. And vice versa. It's not happy wife, happy life, ladies and men. It's happy. Everyone should be happy. It's a symbiotic relationship. A woman that satisfies and makes her man happy by taking care of him, by cooking for him, by taking care of the kids in the house, she strengthens him so that he then wants to take care of her needs. And around and around and around we go. Everyone in a relationship deserves to be happy and deserves to be supported. That's what God wants. And basically ending with this one. God is the highest authority beyond any government instituted by man. Chapter 13, verses 17 through 18. Blessed art thou for having spoken the truth. The king of heaven is greater and more powerful than the terrestrial law, and his kingdom surpasses all the kingdoms of the earth. And the time is not far off when, conforming to the divine will, the people of Israel shall purify them of their sins. For it has been said that a forerunner will come to proclaim the deliverance of the people, gathering them into one fold. Leo Tolstoy, one of my favorite philosophers, was a Christian anarchist. And this is a loose quote to him, but he basically said that no true believer of God, no Christian, can participate in any way serving in the government or serving in the armed forces. In other words, you can't be part of secular government because invariably you will become an agent of that government and do the bidding of that government, which almost always is opposite of what God wants. Just think about, you know, war. Okay, you're fighting a war in defense of your country, but let's be real. Almost all wars today are not fought in self-defense of the people. They're fought for oil and resources and geopolitical control and militarism. They're fought for so many other reasons. They're almost always based on lies. So I appreciate you listening. I highly recommend you buy this book. Again, it's called The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ by Nicholas Notovitch. You can find it on Amazon. It will change your life. And I love this book because it doesn't focus on the divinity of Jesus. It focuses on what did he teach us? How are we supposed to live our lives? I just put together basically his entire ministry in a nutshell in about an hour. How many churches can go through the whole Bible in an hour? Even the New Testament. It's not possible. How many mosques and imams can go through the entire Quran in 1 hour and have you take away the truth? None. These are the spark notes or the Cliff Notes, or whatever they are. This is the beginner's guide to living a godly life and to following in the steps of Jesus. Of course, there's more to learn than just this, but this is the bare bones, basic, you know, foundational information that anyone needs to live and pivot towards serving God and living a godly life. Thank you for listening so much again. My name is Anthony. You've been listening to the Matrix is Real podcast. Please share this with your friends and family. I believe that the second coming is coming. It's on its way. But again, it's not as depicted as in the book of Revelation. And I'll dissect the lies of the Bible and various other faiths and religious books in another episode. But the takeaway is what you've been taught your entire life is not true. And it's up to you to seek out that truth, because nobody's going to do it for you. And until you do it for yourself and take that personal responsibility and truly dedicate your life to God and pursuing that godly knowledge, you're part of the problem and this world will never change. Once again, this is The Matrix Is Real. My name is Anthony. Out.